Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots, and now partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only, and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. The number of U.S. job seekers competing for each job opening has reached the highest point since the recession began, according to the government data released recently. The employment crisis is expected to worsen as companies stay reluctant to hire. Many economists expect a jobless recovery, putting pressure on President Barack Obama and congressional Democrats to stimulate job creation. There are about 6.3 unemployed workers competing, on average, for each job opening, a Labor Department report shows. That's the most since the department began tracking job openings 9 years ago, and up from only 1.7 workers when the recession began in December of 2007. And from the LA Times, hotel defaults and foreclosures in California are increasing. Statewide, more than 300 hotels were in foreclosure or default on their loans as of September 30, 2009, a nearly five-fold increase since the start of the year, according to an industry report released last week. Most struggling hotels remain open, but industry experts believe many properties are likely to be closed down in the months ahead, even if they are not in foreclosure, because they are losing so much money. I've never seen so many lenders contemplating mothballing properties, said Jim Butler, a hotel lawyer and chairman of the Global Hospitality Group for Jeffer, Mangels, Butler, and Marmaro. It can and it will get worse for the hotel industry. Statewide in California, 260 hotels were in default on their loans, and 47 had been taken over by the lenders in foreclosure, an Atlas report said. A leading hotel consulting firm, Smith Travel Research, recently issued a report that predicted no significant improvement for the hotel industry until 2011 at the earliest. It's going to be a lot worse than it is now, said Bobby Bowers, senior vice president of Smith Travel Research. An increasing number of hotels have so little revenue that they can't even afford to pay their operating bills and payroll, not to mention servicing debt. Owners of such hotels are increasingly handing the keys back to the lenders, and the problem is likely to get worse. As many as 1 in 5 U.S. hotel loans may default through 2010, according to UC Berkeley economist Kenny Rosen. In some cases, the lenders are simply locking up the properties. Not only is the recession impacting business and leisure travel, but there are too many hotel rooms and many, many more on the way. And as of October 12th, the breaking news from Wilmington, Delaware, is that the Chicago Cubs baseball team filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, a step that will allow its corporate parent to sell the team in an $845 million deal. The filing in Wilmington, Delaware, was anticipated and is expected to lead to a brief stay in Chapter 11 for the Cubs. A hearing on the case was scheduled for last week. It comes as part of the Tribune Company's plan to sell the team, Wrigley Field, and related properties to the family of billionaire Joe Ricketts, the founder of Omaha, Nebraska-based TD Ameritrade. Tribune, which also owns the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, filed for bankruptcy protection in December, but the Cubs were not included in the filing. The team's run through Chapter 11 is expected to protect its new owners from potential claims by Tribune creditors. Tribune bought the Cubs in 1981 for $20.5 million from candy maker William Wrigley Jr. Company. It announced plans to sell the franchise in 2007, but got tripped up by the recession and the collapse of the credit market. It has agreed to sell the Ricketts family a 95% stake in a deal that tops the record $660 million paid for the Boston Red Sox and its related properties in 2002. Tribune Company is keeping the remaining 5%. The sale still needs approval from the three-quarters of Major League Baseball 30-team owners. The Cubs' bankruptcy filing is not the first for a baseball team. The Baltimore Orioles were sold in a bankruptcy auction in 1993 after owner Eli Jacobs filed for Chapter 11. The same happened to the Seattle Pilots after the 1969 season. The new owners moved the team to Milwaukee and changed the name to the Brewers. The National Hockey League's Phoenix Coyotes, a franchise that has yet to make a profit since moving from Winnipeg, Manitoba in 1996, filed for Chapter 11 protection in May. Now looking to the housing situation, the Federal Reserve is continuing its purchase of Fannie Mae securities as part of its temporary program to directly purchase paper from the housing finance agencies, snapping up some of the securities as soon as they are issued. According to Bloomberg data, the Fed has purchased $136.3 billion of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Home Loan Bank debt since last December. And by writer Martha Neal, toxic titles make mortgage foreclosures a lot more complex. Already dealing with a deluge of mortgage foreclosures, courts in Massachusetts now have a new problem. And although litigation over the issue is further along than in a number of other states, it's a growing concern that is also affecting other properties throughout the country. So-called toxic titles created by the packaging of multiple mortgages into securitized bundles for resale to multiple investors have raised legal questions about who actually owns homes in foreclosure and what procedure is required to transfer title to the mortgage lender, according to the Boston Globe. In Massachusetts, a decision in March by Justice Keith Long of Massachusetts Land Court put banks on the defensive and offered new hope to struggling homeowners, as he held that defective proof of ownership could derail a foreclosure, the newspaper reports. That has put the ownership rights of some who have already purchased foreclosure homes in limbo and slowed down the litigation process for those still in the pipeline as lenders scramble to document ownership. A motion for reconsideration was filed, and a new decision from Long on the issue is expected shortly, the newspaper reports. The fundamental problem is the paperwork was really shoddy, says Kathleen Engel, a law professor at Suffolk University. This mess was created by Wall Street. Standard & Poor's reported in the first week of October that the United Arab Emirates has insufficient funds to pay billions and billions of dollars worth of debts now coming due. The Hawaiian resort industry is also taking a serious beating as the hotel industry in the U.S. faces its most serious downturn since the Great Depression. According to the Wall Street Journal, hotel room demand in the state has declined sharply at a time when the number of expensively renovated rooms is rising. Thus, occupancy at Hawaii's resorts dropped to 66.9% in the first 8 months of 2009, the lowest level since the same period in 1993, and down from this decade's high of 80.7% in 2005, according to Smith Travel Research. Meanwhile, revenue per available room has fallen nearly 25% in the past 2 years and now averages $150.75. That combination means a number of Hawaii's resorts no longer generate enough revenue to pay the mortgages on their properties. Distressed debt tied to hotels is rising across the nation, but Hawaii has more troubled hotel debt per room than any other state, about $23,256 compared with $5,083 in California and $5,345 in Florida, according to statistics based on data from Real Capital Analytics. Overall, Hawaii's distressed debt tied to hotels totals nearly $1.6 billion. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In the second segment of the show, I talk about ways for you to practically take control of your financial situation, how to deal with your debt, and how to make your life a whole lot better. This is an educational part of the show, and I go into a lot of concepts to help you understand what's going on in the background, which often causes problems for people regarding their finances. I always also start with an important credit because many of the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who in my opinion are really the best sources of information, principles, and practical solutions for people, particularly commoners, that means the non-ultra wealthy people, to deal with their financial situation. Their principles are always clear, direct, and simple. Two of their books are All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap, which I highly recommend that you read. Also, you can always go back into the archives at www.kruufm.com under the Life and Debt section to review the prior shows that I have done, which deal with all kinds of issues regarding financial problem. Today, I'd like to begin a series of shows that are based on the two income trap from Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi. This is an investigation as to why middle class mothers and fathers are going broke, with some surprising solutions that change not only our futures, but our children's futures too, if they're followed. Now, it's a fact that there are a lot of people today who are in financial trouble. A lot of these people are family-oriented people, and you may know some of those families, and hopefully it's not you. But the odds are certainly that you do know and see the problems. Over the past generation, the number of American families who have found themselves in serious financial trouble has grown shockingly large. You may look around and think you're in a world where your neighbors seem to be doing fine, and you watch television shows where people never have financial problems and see a lot of the get-rich-quick kind of movies and read about those schemes. It's often hard for us to accept, besides even grasp, the depth or breadth of financial distress sweeping through ordinary suburbs, small towns, and nice city neighborhoods that we may live in. People in America are typical in that they are doing their best to make a good life for their children. They're working hard, they're paying their bills, and we're trying to play by the rules. Yet many, many lose when some kind of disaster strikes. Of course, that disaster often results in bankruptcy for people. About a decade ago, Professor Warren started reviewing some preliminary data for writing her book related to the Consumer Bankruptcy Project. She was looking at a stack of computer printouts trying to verify the accuracy of the samples from people who had been interviewed regarding bankruptcy. Professor Warren indicated that the points were checking off fine when she suddenly saw a single line on a page, which was the number of women in the sample. What she saw was this. In 1981, about 69,000 women had filed for bankruptcy. What she saw on the paper was 18 years later, in 1999, that figure had jumped to nearly 500,000 women, which for her obviously was an unimaginable leap. Her first response was that the data had been entered wrong. Maybe one of her researchers had added a couple of zeros somewhere, or worse still, the research team had somehow pulled way too many women into the sampling, inadvertently producing a huge distortion in the numbers. Her first response was to just think that there was an error, and she actually threw the data into the trash, assuming that they'd be forced to throw out a month's worth of work. As a good researcher, she sent the team back into the fields for more data, which really initiated what was called the 2001 Consumer Bankruptcy Project, which frankly would evolve into what is the largest study ever conducted about families that had failed financially. What Professor Warren had discovered was that there was something wrong, but it wasn't the data sampling she had thrown out. In just 20 years, the number of women filing petitions for bankruptcy had, in reality, increased by 662%. Interestingly enough, divorced and single women weren't the only ones in trouble. Several hundred thousand married women filed for bankruptcy along with their husbands. What Professor Warren's research team eventually unearthed was one stunning fact. The families in the worst financial trouble are not the usual suspects. They are not very young, tempted by the freedom of their first credit cards. They are not the elderly, trapped by failing bodies and declining savings accounts. And they are not a random assortment of Americans who lack the self-control to keep their spending in check. Rather, people who consistently rank in the worst financial trouble are united by one surprising characteristic. They are parents with children at home. Her conclusion, based on the data, and this is a shock, is that having a child is now the single best predictor that a woman will end up in a financial collapse. Of course, for Professor Warren, this was quite a shock and huge concern. Here were some of the facts. Their study showed that married couples with children are more than twice as likely to file for bankruptcy as their childless counterparts. A divorced woman raising a youngster is nearly three times more likely to file for bankruptcy than her single friend who never had children. I can totally corroborate this from my private personal practice that a very large number of divorced women with children file for bankruptcy. In her analysis, what Professor Warren indicated was that over the past generation, the signs of middle-class distress have continued to grow in both good times and in bad, in recession and in boom. And we can see that even more intensified today with the current economy and the loss of jobs challenging so many families. With some simple computations and projections, the first decade of the new millennium will show that many more than 5 million families with children will have filed for bankruptcy through the year 2010. Putting it another way, statistically, that would mean that across the country, nearly one of every seven families with children would have declared itself flat broke, which are really people who are losers in the great American economic game that we all have been seduced into playing. Bankruptcy has become really deeply entrenched in American life. In a typical year of bankruptcy filings, more people will end up bankrupt than will suffer a heart attack. More adults will file for bankruptcy than will be diagnosed with cancer. More people will file for bankruptcy than will graduate from college. And even more Americans will file petitions for bankruptcy than file petitions for divorce. So just to recap, heart attacks, cancer, college graduations, divorce. These are really markers in the lives of nearly every American family. And yet, we will soon have more friends and coworkers who have gone through bankruptcy than any one of these other life events. This seems unbelievable, but in the upcoming series of shows, we will discuss this more and more in depth. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So, continuing the analysis of the family situation with respect to bankruptcy and financial distress, Here are some more statistics. A family with children is now 75% more likely to be late on credit card payments than a family with no children. The number of car repossessions has doubled from the year 2000 to the year 2005. Home foreclosures had more than tripled in less than 25 years, and families with children are now more likely than anyone else to lose the roof over their heads. And these statistics were actually put in writing before the subprime mortgage debacle that we've seen over the last couple of years. The numbers of foreclosures have exploded in America, as has also the number of vehicular repossessions in America. In short, economists estimate that for every family that officially declares bankruptcy, there are seven more whose debt loads suggest that they should file for bankruptcy if only they were more savvy about financial matters. So let's take a look at the unseen dangers. Who are the families in so much trouble? Most are ordinary middle-class people united by their determination to provide a decent life for their children. Many had been felled by a layoff or a business failure, and looking at the tax return, we might label them as poor, but very few were actually chronically poor. For most, poverty is only temporary, a setback in an otherwise solidly middle-class life. When membership in the middle class is defined by enduring criteria that don't disappear when a pink slip arrives, criteria such as going to college, owning a home, or having held a good job, more than 90% of those in bankruptcy would qualify as middle class. By every measure except their balance sheets, the families in Professor Warren's study are as solidly middle class as any in the United States. They are united by another common thread, however. Most of these families sent two parents into the workforce. At first blush, this may sound a little strange. If we use logic, sending a second parent into the workforce should make a family more financially secure, not less. But this reasoning actually ignores an important fact of two-income life. When mothers joined the workforce, the family gave up something of considerable, although unrecognized, economic value. That is, an extra skilled and dedicated adult available to pitch in to help save the family during times of emergency. When a child gets sick, the stay-at-home mother was there to care for him or her full-time without the need to hire a nurse. If dad was laid off, then mom could enter the workforce, bringing in new income until dad found another job. And if the couple divorced, the mother, who had not been working outside the home, could get a job and add new income to support her children. In other words, the stay-at-home mother gave her family what we could call a safety net, which is an all-purpose insurance policy against disaster. If two-income families had saved the second paycheck, they would have built a different kind of safety net, the kind that comes from having plenty of money in the bank. But families didn't save that money. Even as millions of mothers marched into the workforce, savings have declined, and not because families were fritting away their paychecks on toys for themselves or their children. What resulted instead was that families were swept up in a bidding war, competing furiously with one another for their most important possession, a house in a decent school district. As confidence in the school system crumbled, the bidding war for family housing intensified, and parents soon found themselves bidding up the price for other opportunities for their kids, such as a slot in a decent preschool or admission to a good college. Mom's extra income fit in perfectly, coming at just the right time to give each family extra ammunition to compete in the bidding wars. Yet, what this did was drive the prices even higher for the things they all wanted. The average two-income family earns far more today than did the single breadwinner family of a generation ago. And yet, once they've paid the mortgage, the car payments, the taxes, the health insurance, and the daycare bills, today's dual-income families have less discretionary income and less money to put away for a rainy day than the single-income family of a generation or two ago. And so this has given rise to what Professor Warren calls the two-income trap. And that trap has neatly sprung. Mothers are now working two jobs, at home and at the office. And yet, they have less cash on hand. Mom's paycheck has been pumped directly into the basic cost of keeping the children in the middle class. Now, at the same time that millions of mothers went to work, the family needed the stay-at-home mom, or costly replacement, more than ever. The number of frail elderly, most of whom must depend on family for daily care, spiraled upward. Hospitals began discharging patients quicker and sicker, expecting the family to pick up the task of nursing them back to health. With mom in the workforce, parents have been faced with a painful choice between paying for expensive care and taking time off work. At the same time, the divorce rate continued its upward spiral, and the situation has been compounded by a leaner and meaner business climate that closed plants and laid off workers with alarming frequency. So what we see is that in this tougher world, millions of two-income families learned the price of living without a safety net. Now let's flop it to the other side. Inevitably, the two-income trap has affected the one-income family also. Why? Because when millions of mothers entered the workforce, they ratcheted up the price of a middle-class life for everyone, including families that wanted to keep mom at home. A generation ago, a single breadwinner who worked diligently and spent carefully could assure his family a comfortable position in the middle class. But the frenzied bidding wars that have arisen, fueled by families with two incomes, change the game for single-income families as well, pushing them down the economic ladder. To keep mom at home, the average single-income family must forfeit decent public schools and preschools, health insurance, and college degrees, leaving themselves and their children with a tenuous hold on their middle-class dreams. And finally for this week, what about single-parent families, the group that has no choice about getting by on one income? Not surprisingly, they are in even worse shape than their married counterparts. But the magnitude of the problem for single mother families is shocking. More than one of every six single mothers will be functionally bankrupt by the end of this decade. Now, the usual explanations for why these women are in trouble: deadbeat dads who don't pay child support, discrimination in the workplace, and so forth, cannot really account for the growing distress. Today's middle-class single mothers have better legal protection, higher salaries, more child support, and more opportunities in the workplace than their divorced counterparts of a generation ago. Yet, they face a much greater likelihood of financial collapse. Professor Warren estimated that over the past 20 years, ending in the year 2004, the number of single mothers in bankruptcy had increased more than 600%. And we will continue this analysis next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous day.